I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has written The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. Anxiety disorders are the most common mental illness in this country, affecting a huge number of people, 40 million adults, 18 and over, 18% of the population in America. And of course, those who experience everyday anxiety would affect a far greater number of people. Dr. Alice Boyes is the author of this book. She blogs for Psychology Today. She was a practicing clinical psychologist in New Zealand. She's a speaker and author and popular blogger for Psychology Today. She now lives in Las Vegas and will be welcoming phone calls. She looks at a number of different issues, what the trigger points are, how anxiety manifests itself in five important ways in our lives, and will probably offer you some ideas of things that you can do to sort of stop those moments of anxiety that all of us experience to some degree. And she uses a form of therapy to help people move beyond anxiety. So moving beyond anxiety is what we hope everybody will do during the course of this hour. I'll give you our phone number because I think that we're going to have a lot of response and a lot of questions from you. So here's the number whenever you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Dr. Alice Boyes, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I've never been to New Zealand, but I hear it's the most beautiful place on earth.
Yeah, I really love America. So, I mean, I always feel very flattered when Americans say that, but I feel the same way about America.
Oh, you do? Well, isn't that interesting to hear? So they're okay. America is just as good as New Zealand. I hope to see New Zealand someday to make that comparison. It is interesting when you say that most of us have everyday anxiety. The number of people who are anxious and those who are experiencing more severe anxiety is huge in this country, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is huge. So my training, my initial PhD research was on romantic relationships. And then when I got into clinical practice, I realized that anxiety was far and away the most common problem that people were coming to see me for. So that's what I ended up specializing in to a greater extent.
Mm-hmm. And you look at five different areas. Does anxiety manifest itself most usually in these five different areas? And you should probably tell us what they are.
Yeah, so you have different types of clinical anxiety disorders, and then you have underlying threads that tend to occur in people who have got an anxious temperament. So the book, the techniques and tips in the book are still likely to be useful for people with specific anxiety disorders, but they're more aimed at people who can remember themselves as being anxious for most of their lives and for whom anxiety tends to crop up whenever they're experiencing stress or a role change or something like that. And some of the common threads and things that causes anxiety to snowball are intolerance of uncertainty, where people wait to take action until they feel 100% certain, and that causes a problem with hesitancy and overthinking about decisions. Rumination, which is when you replay events that have happened over and over and over again, even small things like, you know, an awkward conversation that someone might find that bothering them for days or even weeks. Fear of feedback and criticism. So people who are anxious often avoid getting feedback, and then that has a snowball effect where the more they avoid it, the more anxious that they get, and that the harder it is to expose themselves to feedback. And then you've got general avoidance coping, which is a common thread across all of the garden variety mental health problems. So the anxiety disorders, eating disorders, depression tend to be characterized by avoidance coping, where people avoid the things that make them feel anxious. And then over time, their anxiety increases because of that avoidance, and the person gets less and less confident.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think I missed one, which is perfectionism. Which
there you go. Yes.
Yeah.
And most of us, do you want to talk more about how that manifests itself?
Yeah, so there's a real increasing amount of research showing that perfectionism can actually negatively impact your performance rather than enhance it, and that it's associated with lots of negative consequences. So we talk about clinical perfectionism, where people are getting into that zone where their perfectionism is getting in the way of their relationships and having a negative impact on their performance rather than the positive impact that they hope it will have.
What is, you describe yourself, and I would describe myself as well, as having a somewhat anxiety-prone nature. What is the difference? Is it substantial? And would you treat people in different ways for an anxiety-prone nature and for an anxiety disorder?
Yeah, so there are specific treatment packages that are designed for specific anxiety disorders, like panic disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder. All of those types of clinical problems have specific treatment packages for them. And if someone suspects that they've got one of those problems, then they probably should go along and have a legitimate treatment package for that problem. Now, occasionally you get people who present with an anxiety disorder out of the blue, and they don't identify as having an anxious nature. They don't remember having been anxious through their life. But the more common scenario is that people will remember being anxious, will identify as being an anxious person. So therefore they need some tips that are lower intensity that they can use after treatment and to help them in a more general sense, rather than just being in terms of you know, going from having a disorder to not having a disorder. So the book is really aimed at those kinds of emotional hygiene type things that can provide a lot of relief for people who have got an anxious nature.
Mm-hmm. And some of these you provide a lot of, and I think they're valuable suggestions of what people can do in terms of relaxation techniques, in terms of if you're always worried about the worst scenario of a situation, that you need to think about the worst and the best and then the most likely, and you might find your mind in an entirely different place, right?
Yeah, so one of the hallmarks of an anxious nature is that tendency to always think about action as having a negative outcome. So you might think, well, I could apply for this grant, but I probably won't get it. I could ask my boss for a pay rise, but I probably won't get it. So one of the things that you can do is to train your brain to have a second thought after you have that first thought. So you will still have your nature where your automatic reaction is to think of that negative possibility, but then you can get it to the point where thinking of an alternative scenario is almost just as automatic.
I wonder how much of this, I think of my mom, bless her, she's been gone for some time now, but my mother used to send me all the time all of these newspaper clippings. She wrote to me all the time, which was very nice. It was before days of email. Chatty letters, but always included were little clippings of all the things that could possibly go wrong. You know, if you take this street at nighttime, or what could happen to your car, or what could happen to you, sickness, or to me, I must say, and then for presents, I'd get some presents, and then I would get the car safety kit, you know, with the flashers and everything, so when your car breaks down in the snowstorm, and you're all by yourself, and you don't have any blankets, she'd give me all of those things, too, which, you know, made me a little bit nervous, I think. I'm wondering how much of this comes from, if you can have anxiety disorder or just a prone nature because you grew up that way.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interaction between nature and parenting. So sometimes if you've got a really calm parent and you've got an anxious nature, having that calm parent might be always saying to you, don't worry so much, be more positive, be more spontaneous, all of those kinds of things. And that can actually have a rebound effect and make someone with an anxious nature more anxious, because they start to think that there's something wrong with their own nature. So there's certainly a lot of interaction.
Right. You write that less is more when coping with anxiety. So many of the things that people do to try to cope with anxiety actually leads to more anxiety over time. What do we do that leads to more anxiety?
Yeah, so that's why I talk about the term anxiety traps, because they really are traps. The things that people naturally do to alleviate their anxiety in the short term just increase it in the long term. So avoidance coping is the number one offender for most people. So that would be things like, for example, if you don't feel comfortable talking to customer service, then making your spouse do that every time. And then the more you do that, the less confident that you become, so that if you do have to face that trigger, the intensity of the reaction it provokes in you is much bigger. And over time, that anxiety tends to spread out to other situations. And the person really loses confidence in themselves. They really start to think, why am I a person that can't do these things? And that general sense of not being a competent person can be really anxiety provoking. And people can start to worry about their anxiety getting out of control. But it tends to be a pretty direct effect of avoidance coping.
Interesting. And you mentioned not being able to talk to customer service. My mind immediately went to the huge number of people who are afraid to speak in public, that somehow all eyes are on them and they can become incapable of saying much of anything because they're so nervous.
Yeah. So when people have that happen, it's usually they go into a really self-focused mode.
Yes.
Where they start paying attention to their internal sensations.
Mm-hmm.
They start hearing their own voice in their head. They start paying attention to whether they've got sweaty palms and all of those kinds of things. And then it's their anxiety about their anxiety that's the problem. So they start noticing and focusing a lot on what's happening to them and then kind of panicking about that. And they stop paying attention to the cues that they're getting from the audience, or they only pay attention to the negative cues. Like they'll pay attention to someone yawning, but they won't pay attention to someone who's smiling.
Right. There are certain techniques, and I think that they're valuable, that you teach us in the book. And it goes along with a certain kind of behavioral therapy that you have used in your practice before, that there are certain things that work for so many different conditions. And they're just, some of them seem to be common sense, but they're things that we obviously don't practice, or we wouldn't have as much anxiety as we do.
Yeah, so I used to be a clinical psychologist. I used to treat people using cognitive behavioral therapy. And then as part of what I was doing, I was getting contacted by magazines and media asking for tips for more everyday situations. So you can definitely translate those tips that are used in therapy into lower key versions that people can use to deal with more everyday situations. So it's not cognitive behavioral therapy, because that's what you would be doing with a therapist, but it's inspired by cognitive behavioral therapy and uses the same kinds of principles. And a lot of them are quite simple techniques, and that's almost the beauty of them, is that you really can train yourself to think differently in subtle ways, like in a situation where you would normally personalize something. For example, you write an email to someone and you don't get a reply straight away. Your natural reaction might be to think, I must have done something to annoy the person, or there must be a negative reason why they haven't responded. And you can train yourself to think, actually, there's like a bunch of other possibilities of what it should be, and I might never know what the reason is, or I might my only option might be to wait until I find out what the reason is.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll have many of them. We have Facebook comments. I'm going to give you one in just one moment, because it's good and will help other people as well. Our phone number, as we talk about anxiety and how to lessen anxiety this hour, our guest is Dr. Alice Boyes, and she is the author of The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. John in Janesville sends us this message. I teach math, he says, at the college level, and have experienced many students, sometimes repeating the class the students are, who say that they have anxiety that blocks them from performing on the test. A common comment he gets is, I did all this work just a few minutes ago and had no problem, but now in the classroom, I can't remember how to do it. What strategies can I offer my students to get around this anxiety, either before or during the test?
Yeah, so one of the things would be for people to practice reducing their physiological arousal. So just some slow breathing. So slow breathing will naturally slow your heart rate, and that will take you out of that fight, flight, freeze mode, and you become a lot more able to think clearly in that scenario. Doing a lot of practice tests is also something that people can find useful, so that that the cues of being in a test situation, like the timing, the type of desk and pen and setup that there might be, don't elicit that extreme fear that maybe happens with some people. Those would be a couple of the basic tips, and often the basic tips are the things that have the most impact.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to some phone calls. Kim, it is in Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Kim.
Oh, hello. I'm sorry. First of all, I'm so glad to hear a New Zealand accent. I lived in Hamilton, New Zealand for 2 years.
Oh.
And I have always thought that the United States and New Zealand are equally beautiful, but they have some differences. So, anyway, my question is, I'm wondering if anxiety disorder can lead eventually to some sort of other health issues, such as heart or disease or stroke issues. And I'm just concerned about that kind of thing.
Yeah, so that is a common fear of people with anxiety, that they're going to make themselves sick through their anxiety, or that their anxiety is going to become out of control, so out of control that they, you know, become homeless or those kinds of things, or that they lose control in some way. I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm not really able to comment on any of that medical stuff. It's a little bit tricky because, you know, there are of course the odd person who, you know, gets diagnosed with panic attacks, and then you find out that they've actually got, you know, some sort of heart condition and those kinds of things. And I'm not sure that we really understand all those physical and psychological links perfectly at this stage. But it's not really my area, so I probably can't comment too much on that one.
And let's go to John calling in from Minnesota. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, about anxiety and everything, it's like, I got a really long fuse, but I can't hold anything against anybody except when I look in the mirror, and that's the guy that got me in trouble. I mean, I'm dealing with a lot of things right now, but I get by with it.
And do you know what?
But I got a high threshold for a lot of things that I know. I mean, I went coast to coast truck driving and everything, and I ran into a lot of people from coast to coast.
Right.
Yeah. You know? And we're pretty much all the same way, and it's just something that you kind of deal with on your own. And I know that there's other people that can't do that, but I'm lucky that I can deal with, like I said, I got a high threshold for BS, you know?
Yeah. So what's the difference between somebody who just, well, you know, so be it, that's the way things are, I'm not going to get myself worked up about all of this, and somebody who gets worked up about all of this? Dr. Boyce.
A lot of it is just nature. Sometimes what happens for people who are anxious and who are particularly bright or have been rewarded for thinking their way through problems, find that because they've been rewarded so much for their thinking skills, they get really into overthinking and trying to understand what they want to understand the causes of what's going on. And what often happens for them is that the more they overthink a situation, the less clear that they become, and their ability to think clearly is kind of gets worse and worse. So there's a temperament factor, but then there's also a really large extent to which those patterns that people get into are the things that really cause their anxiety problems to snowball.
We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about anxiety this hour of the show with Dr. Alice Boyes, author of The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking about anxiety this hour. Dr. Boyes, you write in the book that we are recognizing that all emotions have a purpose and that our anxiety and fear responses have evolved the way they have because there has to be something useful about them, right? What's useful about them?
Yeah, so that's a big trend in psychology right now is recognizing the value of quote-unquote negative emotions. So people often get told things like, you know, don't care about what other people think of you. And if you've naturally got a sensitive nature, that can be just a really unhelpful thing for somebody to say. And if you think about it, caring what other people think of you is it's an evolved helpful mechanism. So we care what other people think of us as a way to stop us doing things that would end up getting us excluded from our tribe. And obviously getting excluded from your tribe, especially in an, you know, our evolutionary environment, would have been physically extremely dangerous. So those emotions like shame and guilt, they all have a purpose. Anxiety is a hypervigilance system, so it's designed to put you on alert so that you're looking and scanning the environment for potential dangers, whereas fear is more about there's a danger present right now and you get the fight, flight, freeze reaction, which helps you either fight or run away or freeze so that you're less likely to get attacked. And the idea with anxiety is that people try and get rid of those anxious thoughts, but the way we're wired is so that it's not easy to do that because it wouldn't have been a very good system if we could easily distract ourselves from a potential threat. We're designed for it not to be easy to distract ourselves, and we're designed for there to be some false alarms built into the system because the system could never be perfect, and it was way more dangerous to miss a danger that was actually there than to get some false alarms. And then for obviously people with anxiety disorders, they get to the point where their number of false alarms is way too high and the system has got miscalibrated, but fundamentally it's working as it should. It's just that the volume on it has become, you know, way, way too high.
Mm-hmm. Kenesha is calling from Milwaukee. Hello, Kenesha. Hello? Not there. Let's go to Brett in Wauwatosa. Hi, Brett.
Yeah, hi. My question is, it was mentioned earlier about the replaying, like, say, a high-stress conversation or some conversation that you had high anxiety in at that time, and then later on, you kind of replay it in your head over and over again, and you're kind of bringing up those feelings of anxiety again because you're replaying it. How do you just let go of that? What tools do you use to let go of having that constant replaying of the same situation that he can't do anything about
it? Yeah,
anymore.
It's a great question. I think that we've all experienced that. Dr. Boyes.
Yeah, so it is a really great question. And it's that rumination pattern of when people would come and see me, for almost everybody, that rumination pattern was kind of their number one or number two problem. It's incredibly, incredibly common. So there are some emotional hygiene things that you can do in the background so that you're less likely to get those spikes. And some really good ones are those mindfulness techniques. So, you know, doing a few minutes a day of slow breathing and paying attention to your breathing. And while you're doing that, when any thoughts come in, just gently bringing your attention back to your breathing and allowing those intrusive thoughts to move on. And that gives you a lot of practice outside of a really anxiety-provoking situation of bringing your focus back to what you want it to be on and gently moving it away from any intrusive thoughts. So that's something that you can do. One of the big things is recognizing when you're ruminating. So ruminating sometimes can be a bit like daydreaming in that you can end up having having been ruminating for quite a long time before you even realize that you're doing it. And we know from, there are some studies that show that even breaking your rumination just for a few minutes by concentrating on something else can really help that rumination be less sticky. So that's something that people can do. And then what you also want to do is take away the fuel sources, take away the gas for the rumination. So the gas can be things like self-criticism. So self-criticism is really going to intensify and prolong rumination. So you want to replace that with self-compassion, where you give your, where you talk to yourself kindly about whatever it is that you're feeling, regardless of the cause. And then you kind of, after you've done that kind self-talk, you ask yourself, well, what's the most useful thing I could do right now? You know, is the most useful thing to try and smooth over a situation, or is it to just let it go and see how it plays out? So you use that kind self-talk, regardless of whether you maybe didn't handle something as well as you could have. I mean, we all do that. We all have situations. It's part of the universal human experience where we wish we hadn't made the mistakes that we've made, or we wish we'd handled situations better. And then the other common fuel sources are things like over-checking. So it might be after you've had a relationship breakup, every day checking that person's Facebook page or ex's Facebook page, or always asking mutual friends if your ex is, you know, dating anyone else, or those kinds of things. And that kind of checking and reassurance seeking really intensifies and prolongs rumination as well.
I don't know about you, Brett, but I think that a lot of us, myself included, find those ruminations take place right before you're going to sleep, and you just can't go to sleep, right? You just go over and over the same thing.
Yes. So, all right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much. Those were helpful to many of us, I'm sure. Michael is next in Appleton. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi.
Let me start with, my wife is not a native English language speaker, and she, in fact, English is her fourth language.
Whoa.
She's very competent in her career, but faced with a customer service situation, she totally freezes and then is often unhappy with the results. And so consequently, I end up handling most of those kind of situations that affect us. And I'm just wondering if there's something I might do to encourage her somehow to help her be more successful with those.
Yeah. I mean, it's always a delicate balance in relationships, right? Because you always have scenarios where one person is better at doing something than the other, or one person is more comfortable doing something. So there is sometimes a bit of a delicate balance between not encouraging avoidance and also, you know, dividing labor in terms of what you're each most comfortable with. So, and I think it probably really has to come from the person. It's hard for it to come from somebody else. And of course that you can encourage, but you can't, you know, you can kind of lead a horse to water, but it probably is going to have to come from the individual themselves, that it's something that they want to change. So your only real option is to be kind about it, you know, to empathize about that, how it is anxiety provoking to call customer service for, you know, most of us, and to maybe set some limits about what you will and won't do. So, you know, things like sometimes people will ask their spouse to, you know, call the bank and, you know, pretend to be them, or to do situations where they feel something's uncomfortable. And, you know, there, you also want to just put those limits in about what you will and won't help with.
Yeah, that makes sense.
She could always talk to them in a foreign language, see how they respond, right? Make fun of the whole situation in some way. Thanks, Michael, very much for the call. Isn't that something? Five languages. I wish I could do that. Five languages. Our phone number and lines are open right now if you would like to join our conversation. We're talking about anxiety, and with the author of The Anxiety Toolkit, Dr. Alice Boys, strategies for fine-tuning your mind and moving past your stuck points. You've mentioned a little bit of social media. It is in the book as well. I'm wondering how all social media, you know, Facebook, all of these messages that we're facing, and sometimes not very kind messages that, or somebody takes you off the friend list on Facebook or whatever. How does social media lead to perhaps an increase, if any, in anxiety?
Yeah, so we're wired to be exquisitely sensitive to signs of social acceptance and social rejection. It's what keeps things cohesive and harmonious for us, and, you know, given that we're a social animal. So that, you know, that wiring is in there, and it's generally a good thing. But in with email and with social media, there's two aspects to it. One is that it's often asynchronous, so you don't, unlike any other conversation, you don't get a reply straight away. So you often get left hanging, which then leaves a lot of time to get anxious. And then, of course, the context cues are missing for something. So you don't know, like, if someone usually likes your stuff on Facebook and then all of a sudden stops liking your stuff on Facebook, what's the reason for that? You know, did Facebook just change their algorithm and stop showing your stuff in that person's feed? Or, you know, did that person get busy and decide to have a few days off Facebook? Or you never know what's going on, but that doesn't change that natural, exquisite sensitivity that we have.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that there are certain things in modern life and in certain jobs that can lead to anxiety. You spent part of the book talking about excessive responsibility taking, people who don't want to let people down, that they work very hard, they work past 40 hours a week, they just keep going, very little time for themselves, take on way too much, and it's not very good for you. And I would imagine if you're anxiety prone, this could really lead to anxiety.
Yeah, definitely. And it's what's really hard for people often is that there are, we can all think of times where the reason that we've been successful with something is because we've gone that extra mile. And life is so competitive these days that often you do need to go the extra mile to sort of rise above all the other competition. But then on the other hand, you've got those types of perfectionism that can have a negative impact on performance, where you end up overchecking to the point that it becomes really unhelpful, or it becomes really paralyzing. And it's hard for sometimes people to differentiate those two things, to differentiate the kinds of conscientiousness that are actually useful to them and the types of perfectionism that get in the way of their life and their relationships.
And we welcome more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about anxiety this hour of the program. It affects so many Americans. The figures are, according to the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, the disorders are the most common mental illness in the U.S., affecting 40 million adults ages 18 and over 18% of the U.S. population. And then you look at everyday anxiety kinds of disorders that we've all experienced at points in our lives, and then the number goes way up. Our guest is the author of The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. She's an emotions expert, an author, and a speaker, and a popular blogger for Psychology Today. She blogs for them as well, and she practiced as a clinical psychologist in her native country of New Zealand. She now lives in Las Vegas. So here's the number if you want to join us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and let's go next to Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a clinical social worker therapist here in the Madison area, and I'm interested in study of existentialism as a philosophy and as a modality and working with my clients. And I'm putting a plug in for anxiety. You know, we're humans and we're on this planet. And if you want to be halfway honest with yourself and with what we have here, there's going to be a base level of anxiety. And, you know, sometimes with myself, with my clients, I work to embrace that, you know, just that part of this experience in being human is feeling pain and feeling anxiety.
And so how do you accept that? How do you embrace it? How do you teach people to embrace that, Eric?
Well, you know, there's a million ways that we run from it, by McDonald's or drugs or movies or whatever. Right. Every second we're grasping to get away from it. So it starts with a shift in a framework of how we relate to it. You know, let's start having the conversation and the belief that this is normal, you know. And by the way, this is what, you know, Buddhism is all about, too. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm plugging that as well.
That's all right. Dr. Boyce.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So, you know, and that really is a trend in psychology at the moment, is this recognition. We went through this phase with positive psychology, which was very, very useful, because until that point, you know, positive emotions had been overlooked. But there was kind of like a stage that people went through where it seemed like everything was saying that being happy increases productivity, or it's always your performance will always improve if you're happier. And we can all think of, you know, who would ever file their taxes honestly if it wasn't for anxiety about getting audited? Like, there's, you know, the fear of dying, for example,
sure,
is one of the things that causes us to make the most of the health that we have, and those sorts of things. So there's, you know, anxiety is as useful an emotion as any of the other emotions. And so this idea that you've got that some emotions are negative is probably a little bit of a mischaracterization.
Mm-hmm. And what about his point, which we haven't covered very much, how often we tend to drown out those anxiety disorders, be they major or more minor, through drugs, through alcohol, through numbing ourselves?
Yeah, so there's two sort of types of therapy that are the most common. There are the mindfulness and acceptance-based therapies, which have those roots in Buddhism and have those roots in those philosophies. And then there's the cognitive behavioral-based therapies. And both of them offer a range of tools and strategies and ideas and different ways of thinking. And you never know which of those approaches is going to work best for a particular person. And that's kind of why in the book I've included strategies from both of those different branches of psychology, because it's good for somebody to have exposure to both ways of thinking and see what works for them. But we've definitely moved from this idea that you want to change your thoughts to more of an idea that you want to change your relationship with your thoughts. So you want to be able to recognize that a thought is just a thought. And, you know, all of that stuff comes from the Buddhist traditions and those Eastern philosophies.
Let's go to, thanks very much, Eric, for your call. Elena in Appleton, hi.
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 Hello.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a question. I have had anxiety most of my life, and I think the biggest problem I have is sort of situations where I can't control things, like, you know, I can't control the outcome, basically. And I have a really hard time letting situations go, ruminating about them, and things like that. And I'm just wondering, how can you get over that?
The key point is that you can't get over it, right? That it's that the more you try and eradicate that from your life, the more problems that you have. So people often use terms like beating anxiety or curing anxiety. And the more you look at it like that, the more problems that you'll tend to have. So there's this idea that, you know, if you fight with anxiety, it will fight back. So it's more you want to get into more of an acceptance of your nature, and acceptance of the way that you react to things. And then the paradox is that acceptance causes those spikes in anxiety to pass more quickly. So you have a situation that, you know, that affects you. So, it's, you know, this still happens to me where I'll have something that will happen and it might make me feel a bit off for maybe like 36 hours or something like that. But it kind of naturally passes on its own. So if you're someone that's got that sensitive nature where things do affect you, just kind of to using some emotional hygiene strategies to break those rumination patterns, and using some techniques to balance your thoughts so that you make sure that you're not making a mountain out of a molehill, or you're not jumping to a conclusion. And once you've done all of those things, there's also like a really important element is just that acceptance that you do react the way you do to things, and you sort of need to allow those emotions to naturally pass, which is what they're designed to do. All emotions are designed to be signaling systems, so that they're designed to be temporary, and the thing that causes them to get stuck tends to be the ways that we cope with them.
Thanks so much, Elena, for the call. Gail in Prairie du Chien, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Gail.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, my sister, 5 years ago in June, she found her oldest daughter who had health issues. She found her dead.
Oh.
And she suffers from panic and anxiety attacks very, very badly, to the point where she's ended up losing her job of 19 years because the man who took over the company thought she just wasn't getting over it quick enough.
Mm-hmm.
And she has trouble sleeping. She, you know, she's up all night. She, you know, will call, and all anybody can do is just let her vent and listen to her, but she cries and cries and cries. And I guess I'm just afraid of losing her too.
Is she seeing somebody? Is she getting professional help?
She has. Yeah.
She has.
She's been to medical doctors. They have her on anxiety pills and antidepressants, and you know, and all these things that really just mask it, don't really, you know, help it go away.
Mm-hmm.
But she has gone to psychiatrists. She has, she's done almost everything I can think of, and she cannot get that picture out of her mind.
Yeah,
finding her daughter.
I know. Oh, I feel for her. It must have been horrible. Dr. Boyes, can you offer help?
Yeah. So we know that the most effective kinds of treatments for post-traumatic stress and for panic disorder are techniques that involve what we call exposure, different forms of exposure. And there's just buckets loads of research that show that for those types of problems, that therapies that involve this exposure element pretty much outperform any therapies that don't have that included. So I mean, that's the type of therapy that would be the most recommended in that scenario. Now, sometimes it does take people a few goes at things before they find the right person to work with, before the place that person's at in their life matches up with the personality styles of the therapist and the training of the therapist. But that's looking for somebody that does cognitive behavioral therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder and panic disorder specifically would be the first place that I would head in terms of that. None of the therapies that we've got work for everybody, but you kind of want to start with the thing that you know works for the majority of people.
Right. Thank you. And if you find that right person and the right drugs and the right therapy, it really can help, but it's so important. And as you said, sometimes you just have to keep going to different places until you find the right person.
Yeah, and you know, people. I think that is important for people to know that, because people often reach out for help, and then if something doesn't click for them, they think that it's them, you know. And as a therapist, you always you do your best all of the time for every single client. But there's the odd time where someone comes in and you just don't you just know that you didn't click in that moment. So, mm-hmm. and that happens to even the best of therapists. So people shouldn't blame themselves for if that happens to them, but they should try and educate themselves about what are the types of therapies that tend to have the highest success rates, and be willing to try those therapies, even if they sound like they'd be something that would be unpleasant to go through.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call, and I hope your sister finds the right person. Let's go to Dave in Pewaukee. Hi, Dave. Dave, are you there? Christopher in Madison. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is, can you make an explicit explanation for me to helping use your techniques and insights to solve or dissolve racial tension in America?
Oh, my goodness.
You understand? We have a horrible, you know, problem in America about between the races, and I'm sure anxiety has something to do with this. Could you be explicit, say how that would work or what we could do personally to solve our own anxieties about this situation?
I think it's probably a little bit beyond the scope of the book. I'm not sure that I have anything that comes to mind particularly to say about that.
Well, I would imagine that dealing with it on a personal level, that if you're less anxious about everything, then you can. It's easier for you to be more confident, to speak up for racial equality, to speak up for matters of peace, to not be afraid of other human beings, or to feed into anxieties about the other human beings. I mean, I'm sure that if you can live on a more even keel, that you can perhaps become, and I think your book deals with this too, a more compassionate soul.
Yeah, I guess it just seemed like a really big question.
Right. It is. It's a very big question. Yeah.
I'm thinking about Starbucks and their recent attempt to solve racial tensions in America, and I'm like, "Oh, this is a question for somebody who's thought more about it than me."
Yeah. Every little bit helps though. Christopher, thanks for the call. Mike, traveling in Wisconsin. Hi. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go right ahead.
I was listening to this, and it's very personal because since my college days, I struggled with anxiety, mostly as a kind of a post-traumatic thing from a drug experience that was very bad, you know, in my early college days. And then as a result of not understanding how the anxiety disorder worked, I didn't deal with it. But back in 1990, I started in therapy because I had a break again. And I got to the point where I was completely agoraphobic and couldn't leave the house and those kind of things. But what's interesting in listening to this is that the doctor is saying, and I forgot her name, is that it's all very, very true, because I spent 11 years in therapy because I found a person who was very good and I could work with. I did my own reading. There were several workbook things out there that I purchased, and as a result, I was able to kind of piece together how this works inside the body. You know, the body skills, use the medication as a part of the tool bag, and then a lot of practice with your body skills and learning how to rethink and reorient your patterns in your brain. Jeffrey Schwartz, neurobiologist, I think out of UCLA, has written a book called The Mind and the Brain, which kind of deals with that. And then the whole Buddhist approach, you know, where you learn to just let thoughts go through, understanding that they're there, that's just what they are. I really liked her analogy about the gas. I use with people that I come across who struggle with this, is I call it throwing logs on your fire. You know, everybody does that to each other. And I think that's one of the key things, is that you have to learn how to catch them and throw them back.
Hmm.
So that, you know, you always will have a fire inside you, and an anxiety fire at some level. But people inadvertently or intentionally will try to throw logs on your fire, and you have to be able to say, nope, that is not going to happen. I want to keep this small.
Thank you, Mike, very much. On those important thoughts, we will say goodbye to the topic. Dr. Boyes, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Dr. Alice Boyes, her book is The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. All Things Political on Monday, and then a documentary filmmaker who looks at a quiet revolution happening in medicine.